Good morning, everybody.
Is this working? Yeah, I guess it is. So some of you who are back there are chairs in here if you'd like to come in. And there are cushions, too. This morning I'm going to talk about what probably is the most common expression in Soto Zen Buddhism, which is wholehearted effort in each activity, just doing whatever we're doing and giving ourselves to it, whether it's sitting in meditation or brushing our cat, or sweeping the walk, or whatever. Reading a book. So this very simple practice that's kind of the foundation of Soto Zen, in monastic settings in Japan and also in China, there are two predominant forms. One form is what's known as a specific Zen form, and the other form is more the general Mahayana, the general Buddhist form. And the Zen form is called Jiriki, self-power, because it takes some self-power to do this sitting, facing a wall, day after day, month after month, year after year, and sometimes having some results and sometimes having no results, and sometimes having a calm mind and sometimes having a mind that's totally out of control. So Jiriki, self-power, is the what really in some senses differentiates Zen from the rest of Mahayana. But the other component of wholehearted effort in the monastic settings, and when I say the monastic settings, let's not forget that in contrast here in the U.S., in Japan and China, that's what you had. That's where people were doing what we're doing, in the monastic settings. A few lay people, but not very many. So the other one being Tariki, which means other power. So the wholehearted effort then is to give yourself away to the other, whether it be the broom or your partner or your roommate who's dissing you, to engage, to see the power in the other. And of course, in Buddhism, this specifically in Mahayana Buddhism includes the bodhisattvas, the Buddhas, the chanting, the bowing, and in some Zen schools that's really de-emphasized. In the Zen school which Uchiyama Roshi manifests, and we're thinking about Uchiyama Roshi because on Tuesday nights we're studying his interpretation of Bendo Law, which Uchiyama manifests, it's mostly just sitting. That other stuff they don't do. But then you'll find some Zen places in the U.S. and in Japan and in China where it's mostly just all this chanting and bowing and manual labor. And now, if I had known about that in the beginning, I wouldn't have done Zen. I only gradually sort of got introduced to that and struggled with it and gradually accepted it, but I wouldn't have done Zen, and most of my friends wouldn't have done Zen if we'd known about that first. But those are two types of samadhi-inducing activities. Samadhi, two meanings, concentration, and then absorption, big absorption, which is not just concentration, way beyond it, because the mind is completely still, and there's the concentrated object is no longer an object. The concentrated subject is no longer a subject. And this actually happens. You can read about it, but I don't care. It happens. Read about it. Ask me all the questions you want, but do it, please. That's what this is about. And both of these practices, Jiriki and Tariki, self-power and other power, result in what Dogen calls self-fulfilling samadhi. Self-fulfilling samadhi. So our fulfillment comes from the open-hearted practice, from the just the sitting, just the giving, just the action. And there are some key features to this wholehearted effort that I want to talk about. First of all, this idea of self-fulfillment samadhi, self-fulfillment engagement, in which we concentrate and then go beyond that to being absorbed in everything, it introduces a word that has not been used in Buddhism before Dogen for like 1,000 years. It was a no-no word, that there's a self. Because Buddhism, from the time of Buddha, there was no self. The self was just a fiction. The self was just a fabrication. The self was just a storyline. But then Dogen, being a Zen teacher, being a pretty, what kind of Zen teacher? Pretty malleable, maybe? Malleable? Whatever. Confident and malleable, both. He introduces the self back, and he says, this is about fulfilling the self. This is about self-fulfillment. That's how we practice. Because we fill ourselves up when we just do an action and give ourselves to it. Doesn't matter whether we're just hanging out with a friend and really listening to her problems, or whether we're trying to cook an exquisitely delicious meal and fumbling around because we don't remember. That's the practice. And it fills us up when we do it, when we don't compare. And when we compare and we evaluate, it's not wholehearted. How can it be? That's a contradiction. So it introduces a big self, which is not just a little complaining Tim, right? Doesn't kick out complaining Tim. It just goes way beyond that, right? And secondly, second feature of this wholehearted effort is enlightenment. But for Dogen and for Suzuki and for Katagiri, this enlightenment is not some experience we have. It's the wholehearted effort of engaging with all life. And when that engagement takes place, then there's sambodhi, as it says in the Heart Sutra. There's being awake with. Sam means with, bodhi means awake. There's just a simple wakefulness with you, with that, with all of it, with the heart, with the anxiety, with the pain in the shoulders, with a deep calmness. Just a simple with. So it's not something that someone has. I've got it, you don't. You have it, and I don't. That's what we always think about. That's what we're always caught about in human culture, and especially at Zen centers. So that becomes our kind of paradox to deal with, doesn't it? And the third important part, important component of this wholehearted effort is persistence. Persistence. Yes, yes, persistence. Persistence is crucial because we're always screwing it up. we're always regretting how we did it before. And we're thinking, this Zazen, I've been doing it for 32 minutes. And my mind is worse than when I began. I've been doing it for 32 weeks. And my mind is worse than when it began. I've been doing it for 32 years. And look at my mind. Bob Dylan and I are on the same page when we say, if my thought dreams would be seen, they'd put my mind in a guillotine after 32 years. Woo! Woo! Persistence. Persistence, because you get so easily discouraged. Because it's the same monkey mind. Always coming back up. Coming back up. And what's quitting mean? Quitting means not starting up again. Not starting up again. Anything you quit, you're closing your heart down. You're saying, ah, I can't do it. I'm not open to life anymore. I'm not open to this anymore. But when you open your heart back up, when you make heart, as some teachers, Zen teachers said, I like that, making heart, then you're starting all over. And you may be needing to remind yourself about this. And going along with persistence is what? Not thinking you've reached the destination. Not thinking you've reached the destination. Regardless of what it is. Finally, as a result of all my wholehearted effort in this building here for however many years I've been doing it. I don't even want to tell you how many years I've been sitting in this building. Finally. Oh, finally. I got it. Finally, my mind is still and blissful, and finally I got a little bit of composure. Finally, after courting you for 2 years, I finally got you as my partner. Wow, I finally got the job, I finally got the girl, I finally got enlightenment, I finally got it. Right? I finally got it. And that's human, that's what we want. We want to finally get it. That's why we do things. To finally, we said, oh no, I'm practicing Zen. I'm free from all that. Yeah. The minute you say that, you're not. The minute you say that, you're not. So don't think you've reached the destination. So, I have a story about that. When I had an enlightenment experience years ago, I had an enlightenment experience. We need to be careful of these words and what we carry around. But that was, I had an enlightenment experience, is how it seemed. So then I left the Zen monastery, and about a week later, and I went home to see my mother. And I went home as an awake being. I entered the monastery as a screwed up being, but then went home as an awake being. Woo! An awake being. And I thought, boy, wait till I see my mother. Wait till she sees how all this, she feels the calmness. Wait till she feels it. And I went home to see my mother. And I walked in the door and my mother said, you look skinny. Have you been eating? What do they do to you down there? And immediately, my awake mind was gone. Completely gone. There was no trace of it. It was just, oh, I thought, oh, shit. Here we go again. Here we go again. So, again, the expression for enlightenment in our tradition is sambodhi, awake together, wakefulness together. And if I think I am awake, then I'm not. It's not wakefulness together. It's not wakefulness together. And of course, if I say I can never be awake, that's too bad too. Because you can. You can open your heart at any time to this practice. It's very simple. So simple. But it requires that effort of making heart persistently over and over again. And the fifth one, I just developed these myself, so they're not in any scripture or anything. Although we could make this some scripture, I suppose. They like to list things, you know, in scriptures. So number five, view fear as an opportunity. Well, of course, this is one I've been talking about all the time, but it's very important. View fear as an opportunity. See the crap within the self and within the world, and don't turn away. When we turn away, we close our heart. We protect ourselves. We freeze. We close our heart. And that's not Zen practice. How can that be wholehearted? So, facing fear, being open to it, seeing where we're frozen, breathing into that, breathing out of it, acknowledging it. Acknowledgement, breathing out and breathing in, doesn't mean indulgence. It means careful attention. Careful attention and devotion to taking care of it. So my example of that, which I may have gotten given before, was that about, in my own life, was that about 17, 18, 19 years ago, I began developing programs in my other vocational capacity for people with serious and persistent mental illness. And that became something I really have done a lot now. And then I began speaking to groups after I'd been developing the programs about serious and persistent mental illness, like churches and especially churches. I talked to a lot of churches, but other groups too, Rotaries, about serious and persistent mental illness and about the stigma and how we were working as a culture on breaking through the stigma. So I've been talking probably publicly for, and I have a sister with schizophrenia, so I can talk. So I can share my story, and that's what people always want to hear, and then they'll talk about their stories. And I have a brother who committed suicide. I say have because, you know, the dead are still with us. But I had a brother who committed suicide. And I've been talking for like maybe 5 years, something like that. And then one day I realized that I only talked about my sister, that I never mentioned my brother. And I saw then that I was closed down about my brother. My shame, my guilt, in spite of all these years of zazen, oh, I was closed down about that. And I actually saw it one morning when I was sitting. You know how some stuff just comes up sometimes? When your mind's not racing, things just come up. I saw that. And then that's partly because I felt as someone who was 10 years older, I was the oldest in the family, he was the youngest, I felt partly responsible for this. And I felt shame, all kinds of feelings. I won't go into all that stuff. and I hadn't even known that my heart was closed down to that part. So then I began talking in my public speaks and all talks, and all of a sudden people started asking me to come back. No one had ever asked me to come back to talk before at a church. I would talk at these churches, usually on a Tuesday night, sometimes on a Sunday morning before a sermon, and they would all be polite and they'd all leave. But then when I started talking about my brother and my own pain, wholeheartedly, without being closed down, everybody came back. Everybody wanted to help and support. So there's an example from my own life. But each of you have examples from your lives. I know you do. I know you do. So it takes a leap, this wholehearted practice. It takes a leap from self-involvement, from closed-downness, to involvement with all life. And it requires doing something that doesn't seem possible. Often, it doesn't seem possible to really be wholehearted about something that you don't, that's hard for you, that brings up scare, brings up fear, or brings up guilt, or brings up whatever. So that's the fifth one, viewing a fear as an opportunity internally and also externally. Culturally, we do this. Culturally, as a society, as a community, as families, we're always closing down stuff. And the Zen practice is about opening up the heart to it, opening up the heart. So something like, I don't know, late 70s, we had a president named Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter. And Jimmy Carter, people diss Jimmy Carter a lot on TV. I don't know why, but anyway, that's a different issue. One of the things about Jimmy Carter was that he had a really wholehearted feeling about the importance of protecting our environment. It was that he really thought about all sentient beings. I mean, he didn't have any Buddhist ideas. He was a Baptist, but who cares? All God's beings, all God's children, including the plants, the animals, the amoebas. And if you read his writing from the 70s, you see how wholehearted he was about that. And you know he was so wholehearted that he actually installed solar panels in the White House. How many of you know that Jimmy Carter had solar panels? Yeah, he had solar panels installed in the White House in something like 78. But it didn't last long. We as a culture had fear. We closed it down. He left and we closed our hearts. We were closed. Our fear was of losing our goodies, of losing our convenience, of losing our SUVs, of losing our wall-to-wall air conditioning, whatever. And so we closed it down. Now, 30 years later, it's coming back because the fear has gotten bigger. He talked about global warming in 78. I remember reading about it. It's 30 years later. We've been closed down for 30 years. And now the fear is getting so big that we're finally beginning to open our hearts to it. And who knows, we may again. You know where that solar paneling is that he installed? You know where it is? Well, Gregan came and he had it discontinued, removed, and it's been in a museum since Reagan came in a museum, together with a horse and buggy, and you know, it's true, So Dogen says that if we're wholehearted in our practice, in our sitting, in our lives, in our relationships, that 10 out of 10 practitioners will attain the way. Wow, what a deal. But of course, then when you look into what does he mean by attain the way, he means, well, don't attain anything. Just be awake with. That's how this Heart Sutra ends. Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi. Awake with. So, now I want to spend a few minutes talking about Soshan. Soto Zen was founded by Soshan and Dongshan. And there's a story in here in your program that I'm going to talk about by the an interchange between one of the founders of Soto Zen in Japan and his student, one of his students. And I'm going to talk about how that relates to this wholehearted effort. If you look, go back and look at these Chinese stories, you don't find much wholehearted effort in there. You go back to look at the Tang dynasty stories, and you don't find it talked about directly. But indirectly, it's always being talked about. So that's what I want to spend the rest of the time on. So in your program, and you can pull it out, or you can just listen to me, I'm going to read this interchange between the founder, one of the two founders, and some guy, student or practitioner or monk, probably a monk. Everybody was a monk then, except the nuns, and they got left out. Sad to say. Okay. So the monk says to Saoshan, I've heard how the teachings say the great sea doesn't harbor a corpse. What is the sea? Saoshan replies, it includes the whole universe. The monk asks, then why doesn't it harbor a corpse? The teacher replies, it doesn't let one whose breath has been cut off stay. Well, since it includes the whole universe, why doesn't it let one whose breath has been cut off stay? The teacher, in the whole universe there is no virtue. If the breath is cut off, there is virtue. Student, is there anything more? Teacher, you can say there is or there isn't, but what are you going to do about the dragon king who holds the sword? Okay. No. I'm going to try to relate that to what I've been talking about. You have to use a lot of sort of creativity, especially with these Chinese guys. Okay. I've heard how the teachings say the great sea doesn't harbor a corpse. So we always want a harbor in our lives. We want a harbor. We want a safe place. We want a place where the sea's not too rough. We want a group that we can belong to. A sangha, a 12-step group, a family. Because we feel adrift. We feel it's hard to practice wholehearted effort continually. And maybe if we get this group together, we can do it. Maybe this group can support us. So we want a harbor. And we have a deep need as human beings to belong, to have a harbor that protects us. Okay? So I've heard how the teachings say the great sea doesn't harbor a corpse. And the sea, what's the sea? Well, in Buddhism, the sea, starting in Yogacara Buddhism, and then the awakening of faith, then the Nirvana Sutra, the sea represents what? It represents the oneness of all life, the undividedness of all life. Actually, what you experience when you're in big samadhi, and there's not any you, and there's just everything. That's what it represents. So the sea represents all everything that's included in this interdependent life of us, of ours. And the Nirvana Sutra says specifically that the sea does not harbor a corpse. So this monk had, they'd probably been studying the Nirvana Sutra in study group, in monastic study group. So the student's asking, well, this sea includes everything. Why doesn't it harbor a corpse? A corpse is part of the sea too, isn't it, teacher? After all, this is a wonderful sea you're telling us that includes even our anxiety, even our depression, because it's a sea of life, it's a sea of death. Why doesn't it harbor a corpse? And the teacher says, It doesn't let one whose breath has been cut off stay. Well, this one kind of makes sense, doesn't it? It doesn't let one whose breath has been cut off stay. When we stop making our wholehearted effort, our breath gets shallow. You'll notice it. Your breath will get very shallow because you're trying to get something from someone. You're worried about not having completed what you wanted to complete. You're concerned about making a good impression, and your breath gets shallow. You're not wholehearted anymore. Your breath is cut off. You're overwhelmed by your anxiety. You're overwhelmed by your discouragement. But in this practice of Zen, we let the water in. We let the waves move us. And we learn how to, as I was saying in class last week, we learn how to surf. We learn how to surf. At first, we maybe need a surfboard. Of course we do. But this sea is very buoyant. It's got level of salt is so extreme that it's impossible to drown in the sea. It's like the Salt Lake. Great Salt Lake in Utah. I've never swum in it. But the sea is so supposed to have such a high level of salt that it's impossible to drown because you float, you come up. I suppose you could even drown in that though if you struggled enough, right? So, this is practicing self-fulfilling samadhi, is breathing deeply as we make our wholehearted effort. And you'll notice when you're really involved in an activity in a one-pointed way without trying to grasp it, that your breath is naturally deep. You notice that, right? You don't need to evaluate it, but it's true. When you're really engaged in an activity, not worried about the destination, not worried about yesterday or tomorrow or accomplishment, your breath naturally goes into your abdomen. And of course, in Rinzai Zen, the focus always is on breathing in the abdomen. And that you practice it. The teacher comes around and shows you how to breathe and then checks your breathing. When you come into Doksan, the teacher looks at your hara, looks at your abdomen. It's true. It's true. And you do the koans right in your abdomen as you're doing deep breathing. But in Soto, we think that's kind of silly. Now, that's our own prejudice. All these different ways have prejudices, so we should acknowledge that. The minute I say we think that's kind of silly, then I'm closing my heart down to something that was probably very wonderful. Very wonderful. So then I just notice that, I deep breathe again, and there it is, the wonder of it all. Wonder of it all. You can always breathe. It doesn't matter how discouraged you are, how screwed up things are. Your breath will always go all the way down if you let it, and then when it'll always release all the way. So you're never as bad off as you think you are. You're always very well off. Because a wholehearted breath will mean you can make a wholehearted effort on that next moment. It will just happen if the wholehearted breath comes up and you're not forcing it to try to get to some place or try to change your consciousness. So then, the teacher says, so the student says, what about this Nirvana Sutra, which conflicts with Buddhist teaching? And the teacher says, well, since it includes the whole universe, there is no virtue. If the breath is cut off, there is virtue. Well, this doesn't make sense at first, but second, if you practice Zen, study Zen very much, it makes a lot of sense. Because when the breath is cut off, we're trying to be virtuous. We're concerned we haven't been virtuous enough. We want to hang out with virtuous people. instead of just breathing and just making our wholehearted effort, we're comparing our lack of virtue to her lack of virtue or his virtue. And I certainly want to be more virtuous than Rosemary. And what? And I want to be doubly more virtuous than you because you were just you were on the city council, and everybody knows that the city council has no virtue. Excuse me. Just a little bit of a political. So we get hung up on this idea, oh, we'll be good Zen students. We'll turn over a new leaf. Finally, I'm going to turn over a new leaf. Finally, I'm going to get my act together. I'm going to show up every morning. 6:42. Oh man, that's too late, you guys. I'm going to show up at 5:42. Well, I can't really come across town. Well, okay, you're going to show up in my den at 6:42 before I go to work, and just sit for 13 minutes, and that's my vow. I'll be virtuous if I do that. The vow you should make, but forget about the virtue. The vow, you open your heart. When you make the vow, you're opening your heart. And then if you go back and complain or criticize yourself, immediately you're closing your heart down. And then you forget about the vow. You don't want to make another vow. You say, oh, screw that vow. You know, I'll make a different sort of vow, a vow that I can accomplish. You can never accomplish any of these vows. You can't. Forget about accomplishing. Make the vow. Do the wholehearted effort. Because virtue is a thing, it's a destination, it's something we want, and it cuts off our breath. It cuts off our sense of wonderful connection with everything. So then, the student says, as these students do, they always get trapped. Yeah. You'd think they would learn if they had read a few of these before. You'd think they could just know. But, you know, the stuff hadn't been written down yet, so they're not wise like we are, right? So the student says, exhausted by now, right? Is there anything more? Is there anything more before I get out of here? I ain't coming to see you again. That's often the way it seems to me they should feel by the end of these things. I'm not back here, not coming back. That's why they wandered around in China. They always wander around. These teachers were not like Katagiri and Suzuki. Well, if Katagiri and Suzuki had done that, we'd all be wandering too. And there weren't any other teachers for us to wander to. So, is there anything more? And he says, you can say there is or there isn't, but what are you going to do about the dragon king who holds the sword? You can say there is something more. I have more teaching to give you. Or you can say, I don't have anything more teaching to give you. I'm just going to shut up now for a while. Completely shut up. Or you can make your wholehearted effort. Or you can be the dragon. Be the dragon. The dragon I talk about a lot in here, right? The Naga. Nagarjuna, the dragon, who is continually shedding the corpse of his skin from the past. Continually shedding corpses. He's not carrying them around. She's not carrying them around. She's a serpent. She's light. She goes in air, she goes in water, she goes through ground. And she sheds skin, she sheds corpses. She doesn't carry around corpses because she's making her wholehearted effort just to be in the air, in the water, in the earth, moving, changing, meeting, practicing sambodhi, wakefulness with whatever. And you don't know what it is that you're going to get. You never know. And that's the joy of this, of the serpent king, of the serpent queen, which each of you are. Each of you are. And you only need the sword. The sword which cuts off that attachment to your corpses. Attachment to all those emotional memories that make you think that you can't go anywhere. And you can go everywhere. But you won't reach a destination. The minute you focus on a destination, you're carrying extra skin. And that extra skin is going to mean that you'll get to your destination, but it'll just be full of skins. It won't have any life in it. Then you'll want to maybe put the skin on the wall and make it, call this the new religious practice, right? New religion, the Naga religion. That would be awful, wouldn't it? But the Nagas wouldn't mind. The serpents wouldn't mind. If we want to do a religion, that's our problem. They don't care. They're just concerned about us. They're concerned that we've forgotten how to be wholehearted. We've forgotten how to be open-hearted. We've forgotten to live with real heart on each moment, regardless of how hard things are for us, regardless how wonderful things are for us. We've forgotten. And so we want a religion. We want a group. We want a harbor. Maybe this will be my harbor, finally. Maybe you guys will all be my good students. Oh, wouldn't that be nice? I can practice here till I'm 94 in this little harbor. Now the serpent is kind. The serpent acknowledges that. And then lightly reminds us. In his lightness of movement, he reminds us that that's all made up stuff. That's all fabricated stuff that we do not need to carry around. We do not need it. And we can, as Dogen says, as good, bad Nagas, good, bad dragon beings, with a sword, Manjushri, oh, this Manjushri has no sword. I don't know. Does he have a sword? No, I don't know why he doesn't. I guess he doesn't need it. I guess he's a Naga. We can live with each other and appreciate each other and enjoy each other and help each other. Help each other. I mean, this civilization is on the verge of collapse. It's on the verge of collapse. So Zazen is more than just some internal practice. It's about doing something about it. But not doing something about it with anger, with fear. Seeing the anger, seeing the fear, and breathing deeply into wholehearted samadhi. Big samadhi. And Dogen calls this disporting ourselves in the Dharma. You know what the synonym for disporting is? Play. You think I'm talking about some heavy thing to do here? Some heavy, grim discipline? Get here when Tim's here at 5:42 every morning and don't smile or say anything for 32 whatevers? Well, you may think that, but don't go that way too far, please. That's just because I emphasize practice in solitude. Practice in quiet, because you have to quiet your mind if you're going to be wholeheartedly in the world. If your mind is busy, how can you be wholeheartedly in the world? You're wholeheartedly in your mind, and then the world is gone. When I saw my mother, I was wholeheartedly, and wait till my mom sees me. And then that was the end, right? That was the end. She saw me. You skinny boy. Often being in some cult. You skinny boy. Wouldn't go to law school like your father said. Mom, don't you notice? I'm transformed, Mom. God damn it, I'm transformed. Linda, I want to get out of here. That's my wife. Let's get out of here. How long did we say we were going to stay here? I want to go back to Tassajara. That's exactly what I said to my wife. Where's my somebody then? Well, it's just shed that skin and come back. We all do it. We all breathe shallowly sometimes. And the opportunity to breathe deeply is always here. Always here. To disport ourselves, to play. In wholehearted giving. The difference between work and play, some people would say, is the difference between focus on destination and focus on just doing this, on just being with this, on just participating in this. Some people would say that. You can believe it or not, I don't care. In the great sea, in the sea of life, the sea of death, living vibrantly in the unknowable. Sometimes we get a harbor. Sometimes we're riding those waves. We come into a harbor. Oh, isn't that wonderful? But the sea is unknowable, so back out to the center. Back out to the center. Or somewhere else. I don't know. That's our life. So, questions, comments? Yeah, Larry.
Despite what the teacher says here.
Pardon?
I say, despite what the teacher, Chao Shen, says.
Yeah.
The breath is confidence. Uh-huh. And if that's not part of the sea or the universe, isn't it still part of the sea that we accept rather than try to...
That's right. Yes. That's the next teaching. There's always a new teaching. That's the next teaching. The next teaching is that we need to take care of the corpses. That there are lots of corpses in the sea. And we actually need to find harbors for those corpses. Now, those harbors won't last for long, but we need to honor the dead. We need to honor our past. We need to acknowledge it. Experience the strength of the wholehearted activity that created this emotional memory in the first place that I'm carrying around. And take care of it. Have a little ceremony for it. Do a little ritual to show it's part of the sea too. And plant it on a bank in the harbor. Yes, important. Acknowledge our corpses. We carry around so much collective karma, so much individual karma, from things we think we shouldn't have done and did that we wish we hadn't done. And our culture, look at our culture. I mean, we have this wonderful, vibrant side of our culture, and yet, at the same time, we're destroying the planet. We're destroying it. Everybody knows that by now. Even the conservative Republicans, most of them have finally realized that. 30 years after Jimmy Carter, with wholehearted effort. So, yes, we need to take care of our corpses. And there'll always be corpses. We'll always have regrets. We'll always have things from the past that come up that haunt us. And then that becomes part of our wholehearted effort just to see those, just to manage them. Just to appreciate them, because they're part of the sea of life. It's the nature of human beings to do this. Thank you. Thank you for your teaching. No, really. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, when it says a corpse doesn't stay in the ocean, I was thinking that a corpse isn't a fixed thing, that when we see our corpses, they become something else. not necessarily a corpse anymore.
That's a good, there's another good teaching. Did you hear what she said? That we carry these emotional memories around, and they create a lot of weight on our shoulders, a lot of weight in our life. They actually affect our organs. Anybody knows that. They don't just affect our breathing, but at some point in our meditation, we see that it's all just a bunch of made up stuff. That heaviness of those corpses is just a bunch of strong feeling from experience in the past that's coagulated. And as we begin to see that and see the components of it and let it be and breathe in and breathe out of it, then it becomes so light that we realize it's not a corpse. It's just, and I don't know if that's what you meant. Pardon?
A corpse can become fuel.
That's right. A good teaching. Fuel. That's another, fuel for the fire. But that's another metaphor. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you both. Any other teachings this morning? Any other questions this morning?
You know, the other thing that we talked about in the study group, and I love this metaphor, too, is that Uchiyama said was when you piss in the ocean, nothing is taken away or added.
That's right.
I love that. Well, it doesn't even have to be pissing in the ocean, anything in the ocean.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Nothing is ever added or taken
away. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yep. Nothing is ever added or taken away. Okay, well, thank you.